Day 3. This is World Trade Watch on Day 3 of the WTO Summit. On today's program,
President Clinton is in Seattle with a no-protest zone declared downtown. The bitter smell of tear gas is in the air, and the World Trade Organization is in deep disarray.
We'll talk to one of our own reporters who was pepper sprayed and clubbed by police while conducting an interview.
Representative Dennis Kucinich, a member of the congressional delegation to the WTO, talks about labor and the environment.
We'll also speak with workers from around the world, including a South African miner, a Mexican maquiladora worker, and U.S. rank-and-file union members.
All this and more coming up on World Trade Watch. First, these news headlines.
In Seattle, I'm Philip Babich with these news headlines from the World Trade Organization Ministerio. Over 50,000 protesters yesterday effectively shut down the WTO Ministerio, flooding the streets of downtown Seattle. Labor and anti-WTO activists peacefully occupied the city, staging giant puppet shows and dances. A colorful array of marchers filled block after block with banners and signs denouncing the WTO. Amidst the demonstration were sporadic but violent clashes with police. Equipped with riot gear, concussion grenades, and tear gas canister launchers, police at times indiscriminately doused nonviolent protesters with chemical sprays, clubbed them with batons, and fired rubber bullets point blank. As evening approached, the city of Seattle announced a curfew and began clearing the city streets. From armored vehicles, police fired pepper spray and canisters of tear gas to disperse crowds. Anti-WTO marchers, choking and tearing, made their way through clouds of the substance as police swept the city. Over 20,000 working people and their allies marched through the streets of Seattle yesterday. The peaceful march was organized by local and national AFL-CIO groups and included union members bused and flown in from as far away as Canada and the Midwest. The march was preceded by a spirited rally at the Seattle Center Stadium. The two-hour rally featured many local and national labor officials and international activists, such as Indian feminist and environmental activist Vandana Shiva.
We grew up on the learning that wealth accumulated without work is not growth, it is not production, it is theft. The World Trade Organization is organizing a world theft organization.
As Wisconsin State AFL-CIO President David Newby explained, global concerns have helped the U.S. union movement to become more global in its organizing.
We have realized that as the economy becomes more globalized, that we have to organize globally as well. And that means that we have to pay attention to the interests of workers in other parts of the world. We have to make sure that we are operating and organizing in cooperation with those workers and not in competition.
Newby told World Trade Watch Radio that this global perspective is somewhat new to organized labor and runs counter to protectionism.
That, I think, is a perspective that the labor movement has not always had. And it's very exciting and encouraging to see that unions are recognizing that the issue is not, as Pat Buchanan is trying to frame it, a protectionist issue, but rather we simply have to change the rules under which goods are produced and traded around the world.
A small contingent of demonstrators, not aligned with the political groups who organized yesterday's rallies and marches, smashed store windows and vandalized buildings and cars, sparking angry responses from local business owners and some protest organizers. This morning, anti-WTO organizers are helping to put Seattle back together by initiating a cleanup effort. Medea Benjamin, who's with the human rights group Global Exchange, said of yesterday's property damage, "This is not the message of the WTO protesters." In a lively debate on the World Trade Organization that took place at Town Hall in Seattle last night, U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce David Aaron questioned the credibility of his fellow panelist Ralph Nader, an outspoken critic of free trade in the World Trade Organization.
One of the things that I find most peculiar in the debate, even the debate we've had thus far this evening, is that former consumer advocates, strong consumer advocates, want to block imports into this country. I can't think of anything more destructive of consumer rights than to block imports, to raise prices, to limit choice. What kind of consumer activism is that?
Nader accused Aaron of repeatedly oversimplifying what needed to be a complex discussion and challenged the Undersecretary of Commerce to a five-hour debate, to which Aaron agreed.
There are times when you want to encourage imports. There are times when you want to discourage imports. Pornography, dangerous toys, contaminated food from abroad. This simple monetized mind that fuels a trade dogma ideology that argues by tautology prevents a society from working justly, creatively, and sustainably.
Those are the news headlines. For World Trade Watch, I'm Philip Babich in Seattle.
Protesters in the streets of Seattle voiced a wide range of opinions concerning the World Trade Organization, but one common theme seemed clear. The WTO and multinational corporations are becoming too powerful at the expense of people's rights and livelihoods.
Just a concerned citizen who's read up enough about the WTO to know that it can't go on like this, that people need to be involved. It's time that we're invited to the table.
The trade is unfair. We're losing a million jobs every year because of what's going on here. American workers in the last 8 years have seen their wages drop because of NAFTA. And the World Trade Organization is just another leg of NAFTA that's going to be taken away. More of our American jobs and lowering our wages to third world standards.
We can't have sweatshops in any country. We can't have children laboring. We have to have decent working conditions and benefits for all working people in every country in the world.
I hope it opens up some eyes, particularly in our country. We're a wealthy country. A lot of people turn their back on the society, oppressed in particular throughout the world. And so it's nice to get this national coverage, and hopefully people will realize that we're not out here trying to be anarchists, but we are out here to try to do something for the world.
An army of law enforcement officials were dispatched to control protesters in the streets of Seattle. Riot police wearing helmets and face shields, shin guards and body armor stood shoulder to shoulder at intersections and in front of key buildings. World Trade Watch's Laura Levati was at a downtown location when police began using their batons, unprovoked, against nonviolent protesters. Even though Levati identified herself with her press credentials, a police officer hit her in the back with a baton.
There's a line of cops poised, looking very stern, holding their batons out with riot gear, helmets, with a plastic face guard down over their face. There are protesters standing in front of them with their fingers raised in peace signs, trying to talk, and the police, you can hear, are pushing the police officers pushing me, even though I'm with the press, with my press pass, sticking a baton in my back. The demonstrators are sitting down, linked arms, screaming, the whole world is watching. The police are lined up in front of them, holding their batons out in riot gear.
The whole world is watching. The whole world is watching.
Laura Levati now joins us in the studio. Thanks, Laura, for coming in. That's very dramatic tape. Are those the police that we hear saying move?
Those are indeed the police saying move, and I think you may also have been able to hear me saying I'm with the press.
What happened next?
What happened next was the police ran over to a young woman who was wearing a gas mask, ripped it off her face. You will hear in the tape that we're about to play some whizzing noise, and that's the sound of tear gas canisters going off, being shot into the crowd. And I should say the crowd was, you know, thousands of people just sitting down, peacefully chanting nonviolence, the whole world is watching nonviolence. And as I said on the tape, a few protesters standing directly in front of the police officers with their fingers raised in peace signs trying to talk to the cops. It all happened very quickly. The police started shouting, move, move. They put the baton in my back, even though I was showing my press credential and saying that I was with the press. I was interviewing a bystander, not even an activist, a woman from Seattle who came out to see what was going on. She was concerned. She wanted to know what the protests were about, how the police were responding, and I guess She got to see how the police responded. I'm sure she ended up in the same condition I did. So you'll hear the tear gas canisters whizzing. The police had rubber bullets. They had rifles with rubber bullets of two different sizes. One was about a quarter inch in diameter. The other rubber bullets were about three quarters inch in diameter. They were quite large. There were also police officers with M16s loaded with live ammunition and armored cars. Some of the protesters went and asked the police officers why they felt they needed to have M16s and didn't get much of a response. But so they started the move. They put the baton in my back and then immediately pulled out tear gas canisters and canisters of mace and pepper spray. And then I was immediately after having the baton shoved in my back, pepper sprayed directly in the eyes from about 2 inches away. And in the tape that you'll hear, I can't speak at first. When I can speak, my voice is very shrill and shaky because I can hardly breathe. It affects your entire system. The tear gas, you know, made me cry immediately, uncontrollably, and I'm very shaken. I can't see anything, and a young man comes and helps me move away. I'm totally disoriented. I can't see. I don't know where to move. In my eyes, and it's burning like hell. I can't open my eyes. I can't talk. I can't even see where I'm going. Somebody's leading me my way. I can't see a thing. I can't see a thing. And somebody's leading me through the street. Can you describe what's going on?
The police have just... They're standing... The police, they've made some arrests and pulled some people off the line, and now they've made another line again. They've got the pepper spray out again. Anyway, this is some real action, people. This is like the WTO is taking over America. Not like the government, but like the corporation is taking over your government. You got to get the f*** out of your seat and do something. Because if you don't, it's going to come and bite your ass, and you're not even going to know it.
And can you say your name into the mic?
My name is Risky Pisky.
Thank you.
Laura, one question that I think hasn't been asked very much yet is, why didn't the police simply arrest demonstrators rather than lob so much pepper spray and tear gas at them?
Well, I think we heard from the mayor of Seattle that a decision was made not to make a large number of arrests. And I think that they did that because they wanted the city not to gain the reputation of not being undemocratic and not allowing free speech. And, you know, citizens of the United States do believe they have the right to free speech and the right to stand up and say what they feel. So, you know, I do think it's appropriate that they allowed the demonstrators, you know, 99.95% of which were peaceful protesters there with a real message to say that message and get that across. What we're seeing now, however, is a totally different kind of response. Clearly, the message has changed from on high, and protesters are being arrested, and they've declared a no-protest zone.
Laura, they did allow the protesters to effectively occupy the downtown yesterday to effectively shut down the WTO. Briefly, what is that message? You've mentioned that they're arresting protesters today. What is that message by declaring a no-protest zone?
The message of the protesters?
From the police. How are the police changing their tactics?
Well, the police are dragging people across the streets. You can see on the television screens probably people being carried, you know, dead weight across the street. They must be getting road burn. They're, you know, not allowing anyone in the area at all, and it's very hostile.
Laura, you're a terrific newswoman. Thank you so much for putting yourself on the line for World Trade Watch. Up next, we're going to talk with Representative Dennis Kucinich.
20 years ago, as mayor of Cleveland, Ohio, Dennis Kucinich defied the wishes of large banks and refused to allow privatization of the city-owned electric utility. Today, he's a member of the U.S. House of Representatives with strong views on a wide range of trade-related issues. He joins us here in the studio. Welcome to World Trade Watch.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's at stake with the World Trade Organization?
Nothing less than the right of people to choose their own form of government, government of the people, by the people, and for the people, as often as we've heard that phrase, is a reality which should be transcendent. And yet the World Trade Organization would undermine that reality, not only in this country, but in countries across the world. So I'd say the democratic principles are at stake.
Well, we hear from the WTO that they exercise transparency.
Well, they say that, but I'd like to look at it another way. I think it's easy to see through the WTO because they permit abuses of human rights, labor rights, environmental principles are trashed, all in the name of facilitating world trade. When world trade becomes the first claim in a world, as opposed to human rights, as opposed to workers and the environment, then we have to look at our values and ask, what are we creating here? And that's, I think, why Seattle is so important. We have to ask, what are we creating? What have we created? And what do we wish this nation and the world to be in the new millennium? It's still within our control to be able to define the kind of world we want.
We're seeing public opinion in this country really turning against so-called free trade. You come from a working-class district in Ohio. We saw labor out in force yesterday marching through the streets. How do your colleagues in Congress react from the message they're getting from their constituents?
We have about a $25 billion trade deficit right now. America's lost heavily in the manufacturing sector. Those are good-paying jobs, solid jobs, which help form communities, solidify them, and create generations of productivity in cities across and suburbs across this country. As we see jobs leaving, it's inevitable that public concern is going to continue to grow. And I think that that's why you saw tens of thousands of working men and women in Seattle for this conference challenging the World Trade Organization and the institutions of government from their respective countries to be responsive to the concerns of people so they can support their families, so they can have a decent quality of life. And the only way to do that is to have workers who are guaranteed the right to organize, who have the ability to be able to form unions, have collective bargaining. The only way we can do that is to have prohibitions on slave labor and prohibitions on child labor, to be able to raise up human rights as fundamental to a democratic society. And the World Trade Organization, in its policies, holds up as barriers to trade all of the qualitative aspects of our life and of our democratic traditions.
It was quite impressive yesterday to see the range of people who were in the streets. A lot of the union folks who were out there marching were probably not people who have been involved necessarily in national protests before, maybe union rallies. Again, how is the U.S. government responding to the fact that the public is making such a strong statement on international trade policy, which is normally considered the purview of policymakers and policy wonks?
I think what's happening is we had a recent development 2 weeks ago I'd like to talk about. I wrote a letter and had 113 of my colleagues sign it in the Democratic caucus, asking the administration to recognize the primacy of worker rights before we have any new WTO agreement. The administration, while I'm sure they would like to ignore the issue, nevertheless has to look at it. And today you see the president announcing that he wants to embrace this idea of having workers' rights and environmental principles included in any WTO agreement. The real test is not going to be in the rhetoric, though. It's really, with all due respect to the president, it's comfortable to come to Seattle and to say those things today. The test will be under on the MFN, most favored nations vote for China, because if China gets permanent MFN and they have a position in the World Trade Organization, we are at risk of having an acceleration of the race to the bottom in terms of all of our rights. And that's why We have to see. I think what the president's doing is trying to soften the climate so the administration can keep advancing the same policies which they've been doing all along.
Well, meanwhile, of course, this is all entangled in presidential campaign politics. Of course, the AFL-CIO has endorsed Al Gore for the presidency. And it seems that John Sweeney has, many observers believe, cut a deal with Al Gore where Sweeney isn't getting much of anything on the WTO and trade issues.
Well, I think that what's happening is that members of Congress and individuals involved in labor around the country are moving ahead to press an agenda which says that workers' rights and human rights have to be of overriding concern. And I think what will happen, by the time we get to the convention, you will see the Democratic nominee, be that nominee Al Gore or Bill Bradley, strongly speak out on these issues. I know it seems rather unlikely at the moment, but I will predict that the Democratic nominee will speak to those issues, and there'll be a ticket which will include a candidate who will be sympathetic and well-known as sympathetic to those issues. But otherwise, it won't be able to mobilize a vote.
But 3 years ago and 7 years ago, Bill Clinton spoke strongly to those issues, and we've seen what's happened.
Well, I think the response in Seattle of people taking to the streets is an example of a lack of confidence that the political system will, in fact, has responded. However, in our democracy, when the political system is not responding, people are known to come forward and insist on their rights, and that's what's happening. And I think that's healthy. I think that's healthy for this country. I think it'll be healthy for the political process, and I think it's going to push both Al Gore, Bill Bradley, and even John Sweeney towards an agenda which will very solidly state the rights of workers. Now, John Sweeney, I have to say, has done a remarkable job in turning around the AFL-CIO. But he's in a position right now where he's finding that he's finding much more support than he ever counted on, I believe, from his rank and file for the most progressive positions that he would want to take. And I think that's good. I think that's healthy. And I think that John Sweeney moves again to the head of the pack in advancing the rights of workers, but because the workers themselves have the rank and file started marching.
And yet he's kind of sounding mollified a bit by this working group formulation where all that's happening is that Clinton is asking for a WTO working group that has no power just to make a report in a couple of years.
Everyone who in our progressive caucus and in other meetings where we discussed the working group on labor, everyone understood it was simply window dressing. And no one gives that any serious credibility, and especially John Sweeney at this point. So labor is not going to be satisfied, nor will labor's friends in the Congress be satisfied with any attempt to try to window dress on basic worker rights. We must have guarantees on the right to organize and to collective bargaining. We must have guaranteed prohibitions on slave labor and child labor. We must have guaranteed upholding of human rights principles. So you can't just create a committee and say, we'll talk about it. That's not going to happen. There has to be something solid. The president knows that. He's talking about it now. Well, the Congress's responsibility is going to be to deliver that. That's why I'm working with my colleagues on the Democratic side and working with Republicans as well to fight for these principles. And I think the Congress of the United States is the one institution which can be responsive to the people. And I think that we will see, just as Congress blocked fast track in 1997, we'll see Congress defeat permanent MFN for China. And that will be the beginning of a new effort in the Congress to reinstitute the power of the people. Furthermore, we're going to see Congress move forward on supporting the effort to strip the enforcement powers from the Justice Department to try to overturn laws that are deemed by the World Trade Organization to be inconsistent with their rules, such as the local and selective purchasing laws that Burma helped to necessitate. And, of course, that's before the Supreme Court. But we're going to see those laws reinstated through Congress passing an amendment that will take out the money to enforce overturning them.
We're beginning to hear the Clinton administration, Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky, begin to adopt some of the rhetoric of their critics, say that they're concerned about labor, that they're concerned about the environment. I think some people both see that as a real victory, that the opposition has been able to move the agenda, but are concerned that it will get co-opted.
Well, let's see. They're learning the lyrics. They're starting to understand the music. Now we're going to find out if they want to go to the dance. And so we'll find out. But it's nice to know that they're starting to tap their toes a little bit as they see the marchers in the street and as they see tens of thousands of working men and women rise up in insistence on their basic rights. So it's nice to see the administration coming along. Let's encourage all of them.
Of course, a lot of people in the streets still seem to believe that the administration is tap dancing along rather than moving along, but I guess history is yet to be determined. One of the signs I saw in a big march yesterday said, "Turtles and Teamsters united at last."
Well, I'm sure that would warm the cockles of a writer like Lewis Carroll. The truth is, taking a page out of Alice in Wonderland, at the moment when the big when the Queen of Hearts and all of her troops were marching on Alice, she turned around, and it says in the book, Alice grew to her full size, swept her hands across and said, "Who cares for you? You're nothing but a pack of cards." We in a democracy need to know that these huge institutions, the WTOs, the IMF, and all of these institutions are nothing but a pack of cards, that the fundamental precondition of a democracy is the power of the people. So I have great hope that the Teamsters and the people wearing turtle suits and all these others will come together and hold hands for democratic traditions, because we do have the ability to unite people on this issue. And the unity is so basic to America, because it's a unity around our right to be a government of the people.
You've been somewhat of a gadfly in Congress. You're certainly a gadfly in the Observer delegation. To what extent do the protests legitimate the positions you're taking, and to what extent do people say, oh, well, you're just part of those crazies demonstrating in the streets?
Well, I think that each one of us has to every day testify to what we believe in, no matter what we're doing. And so we can't worry about what people think of us. We can only have the integrity of our own resolve and our willingness to stand up and speak out for what we believe in. And once we do that, then what does it matter what anyone's opinion is? The only thing that matters is that we believe in ourselves and believe in our country.
The voice of Representative Dennis Kucinich. Thanks very much for joining us here on World Trade Watch.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're listening to World Trade Watch, a co-production of the National Radio Project, Corporate Watch, and the Institute for Public Accuracy. For more information about this series or for tapes or transcripts, call 1-800-529-5736. Call that same number for a free information packet or to get in touch with our guests. Again, that's 800-529-5736. You can also find us on the Internet at www.corpwatch.org or www.radioproject.org. You are listening to World Trade Watch. I'm Julie Light with Norman Solomon. Coming up in this half hour, a look at labor in the WTO and security around Seattle's Trade and Convention Center. As tens of thousands of protesters effectively shut down the WTO and occupied Seattle's downtown, a handful of delegates and a battery of security agents hold up in the convention center. We sent our special correspondent, Prothap Chatterjee, to find out what was happening behind the scenes. He files this report.
Room 301 looks just like any other room in the Washington State Convention and Trade Center. But the men in suits outside the room wear red or orange badges that look quite different from the badges of the trade delegates attending this week's World Trade Organization Summit. The red badges are for Secret Service, and the orange badges are for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Room 301 is one of the nerve centers of what was supposed to be a smooth operation to ensure the delegates could discuss how to increase global free trade. But those plans appear to have gone terribly wrong, as tens of thousands of protesters surrounding the convention center effectively shut down the opening ceremonies for the summit. In addition to the FBI and the Secret Service, there are officers for the Diplomatic Security Service, whose job is to guard embassies and consulates, as well as agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Downtown businesses hired extra private security guards to protect their buildings. Local security agencies are also out in force, including the City Police, the Port of Seattle Police, the Seattle Sheriff's Department, the Washington State Highway Patrol, together with unidentified officers from the United States Army.
So what branch of the military are you in?
I'm not going to talk to you. Don't ask me any questions. I'm not going to talk to you. And the dog will bite, so
I'm not going to provoke the dog.
The men in room 301 are just as reluctant to give any information about what they are doing or what they plan to do. But after speaking to over 20 Secret Service officers, I finally managed to find out who was in charge.
I know the guy in the building right now is tied up, so I'm not even going to call him. Yeah. And he'd be the only one who could. And I'll tell you right now, he won't be able to talk about it. So, I mean, yeah. You know, I know that right now he's tied up in something.
What's his name? Who's got to be looking
Bond, for? Agent Bond. I'm not kidding.
What's his first name?
What, Robert. Yeah. Okay, it's not James.
Not James. So he's the public information officer?
Well, he's in charge of the security of the building for the Secret Service.
Repeated calls to Agent Bond proved to be of no use. The Secret Service office in Seattle politely informs me that he is either on the phone or has not been seen all day. Meanwhile, Agent Bond's men are just as confused as I am.
We're just coming out to see what's going on.
There's really no rhyme or reason. We're just kind of following things.
Meanwhile, Seattle's police chief, Norm Stamper, tells journalists that his men have the city under control.
Chief, we see so many demonstrations and so many protests on every intersection and every corner as you just walk along here. Do you feel the police department has the city under control right now?
I certainly do. Protesters are loud, and protesters are having their voices heard, which is precisely what they want. And that is something that we are protecting. And for the most part, the demonstrations have been very peaceful, and we're appreciative of that.
The swarms of undercover agents and heavily armed officers, however, are beginning to alarm some of the delegates. Glenys Kinnock, a British member of the European Parliament, says that she was rudely interrupted at breakfast this morning.
We were just having a coffee on the ground floor, and then we were all herded up to the second floor because of supposedly tear gas or something. I don't know. I didn't see anything like that. But where I was sitting, cohorts of police dressed in what I'd describe as kind of, for me as a someone from Britain, sort of Star Wars gear with tear gas masks and helmets and big guns.
Other delegates say they cannot believe how badly organized the security officers are. Svend Thauken is the Danish Minister for Environment and Energy.
How could this happen? How in the police wouldn't they foresee such an action? I mean, it's that not that many people, a few thousand people all together. Sometimes it seems as there are as many cops as there are demonstrators.
Auken says the protests are the fault of the World Trade Organization.
I think WTO for far too long has ignored public opinion and therefore sort of dug its own grave in the sense that they had this kind of outpour here in the United States.
But not every delegate believes that the World Trade Organization is at fault. Tim Grosser, the principal economic advisor to the Trade Minister of New Zealand, says that the World Trade Organization has been misunderstood.
It's quite sad what's happening here because, you know, I went through protest movements myself 30 years ago, but we had real issues then. We had apartheid, Vietnam War. We had a legitimate reason, we think, to protest. These people are basically, whether they understand it or not, trying to stop a process that's lifted hundreds of millions from poverty to a decent standard of living where they can start to deal with environmental problems, they can get higher real wages and better working conditions, and bring their own deprived people into a more secure future.
And Keith Rockwell, the official spokesman for the World Trade Organization, says that the WTO is disappointed that their opening event had to be cancelled.
Peaceful protest is an important element in any free society, and I think it's an important component in helping governments to come to the soundest and most really representative policy decisions. Violence doesn't really have a part to play in that, and I understand that a small segment of this of the group, most of whom are kids, workers, people who've come here to express a very serious and legitimate point of view, were just sorry that that there was violence, that some people have gotten out of hand.
Secret Service Agent Bond and Chief of Police Norm Stamper had obviously failed in their mission. Meanwhile, although the vast majority of protests were peaceful, there were scattered incidents of violence and vandalism. Police sporadically reacted, sometimes even to peaceful demonstrators, with pepper spray, tear gas, and rubber bullets, but allowed thousands of protesters to occupy downtown. By nightfall, the mayor imposed a curfew on the city, and Washington Governor Gary Locke called in the National Guard. Police then brought in armored personnel carriers and massively tear-gassed protesters, forcing them to disperse. For World Trade Watch Radio, I'm Protheb Chatterjee in Seattle.
Joining the tens of thousands of trade unionists marching through Seattle are labor activists from around the world. We are now joined by two rank-and-file activists who have been on the front lines for many years. Glenn Mpufane has worked in a gold mine outside Johannesburg for 20 years. In the early 1980s, he formed a union to help the struggle against apartheid. Amparo Reyes has been working in a maquiladora assembly plant on the U.S.-Mexico border for the last 9 years, since she was just 18. She's a single mother of two who puts in a 70-hour work week at an electronics assembly plant making parts for Ford vehicles. Welcome, both of you, to World Trade Watch. Muy bienvenida.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Glenn Mpufane, the conditions that all miners work under around the world are extremely different, especially difficult and harsh, especially gold miners. Can you walk us through your day and tell us about conditions at the Anglo gold mine outside Johannesburg?
Yeah, as you all aware that, mining is a very dangerous occupation, and tens of thousands of mainly migrant workers work in these mines. The tragedy is that when they leave their homes, they're never too sure if they're going to come back alive. But however, with the advent of, our liberation and democracy in 1994, we've managed to have in place the Mine Health and Safety Act, which makes the trade union a very important stakeholder in the safety and management of safety in the mines. So basically, though we still have very high incidence of injuries and fatals, there is a commitment on the part of the union and managers to make mines safer in my country.
And most of the miners actually live on the compound. Do you live actually in the mine compound?
No, I don't live in the compound, but most of my colleagues still do.
You formed an organization which educates workers about globalization. There's a very vibrant trade union movement in South Africa. What is the impact of globalization specifically on South Africa, and how has COSATU and how are the different unions responding to it?
Yeah. I think the formation of SALNET was precisely to educate workers around the and articulate and have them in a position to articulate, and make that connection between their living conditions, and globalization. Expectations are very high, obviously, after independence. And the danger is that the government might be unnecessarily blamed for lack of improvement in the conditions of ordinary folks. So basically what SALNET intends to do is to assist and help workers to understand that when they face retrenchments, when they cannot get health care, when basic services like waters are privatized, it is not necessarily the intention of the government. The government is operating within a given, a new terrain, and that is precisely the whole question around the WTO.
For so many decades, it was clear, so to speak, who and what the enemy were during apartheid. So I'm wondering, in the last few years, now that there's one person, one vote instead of white minority rule, and you're looking at this intricate interplay of economic power, what's the transition like so psychologically and socially and politically to re-identify what the obstacles are for democracy?
I think for democracy to work, you know, it must be translated into real life improvements of the people. Like I said, you know, the enemy before 1994 was clearly, the nationalist government, you know. But since 1994, it is very important, you know, in the balance of, you know, balance of forces at play in South Africa, to be able to identify that your cause, you know, for your poverty is not mainly lying with the government, but it is precisely when you, like I said, have a situation and you cannot feed your family, you know, you live in grinding poverty, you know, and you are locked up in that debt trap. The only way to get out of it, you know, is to have an appreciation of, like I said, the balance of forces at play. It is not the government. Why is it possible that where we expect creation of jobs, jobs are not being created at a scale that would alleviate the poverty? Why is it that companies are disinvesting from South Africa, you know? Why is it that we don't get what you call public works program, you know, that would give people a stake and have people work and bring back their dignity, you know? And it is precisely, like I said, that the government, unfortunately, operates within a given framework.
That's Glenn Mapufane. He works for the Anglo Gold Mine Company in South Africa. He also is the founder of the Southern Africa Labor Network, or SALNET. Also here with us in the studio is Amparo Reyes. She's a maquiladora worker, and she'll be speaking with us through a translator. Amparo, you put in a 70-hour week for which you earn barely a dollar an hour. Can you walk us through your day? Tell us a little bit about your working conditions and how you make ends meet. Amparo, usted trabaja 70 horas por semana, apenas gana un dólar por hora. Si nos podría explicar cómo es su día y cómo hace para darle de comer a sus hijos.
Bueno, pues yo soy madre soltera, tengo dos hijos y trabajaba 48 horas con un sueldo mínimo de 380.
I'm a single mother. I have two children, and I used to work a standard 48-hour work week for $39.
No me alcanzaba y pues tuve que trabajar 59 horas.
It wasn't enough, so I had to begin working 59 hours a week.
Para tratar de darles una alimentación adecuada a mis hijos.
In order to give my children enough food.
Educación.
And education.
Pero ahora con el Tratado de Libre Comercio y la WTO.
And now with the free trade agreement with Mexico and the U.S. and with the WTO.
Tengo que trabajar 74 horas para poder sobrevivir.
I have to work 74 hours a week in order to survive.
You work in a Ford electronics plant. Can you tell us about the working conditions there? Usted trabaja para Ford en una maquiladora de asamblaje de electrónico. Si nos podría describir las condiciones de trabajo ahí.
Pues las condiciones son infrahumanas, ¿verdad? Porque no tenemos el suficiente equipo para trabajar.
The working conditions are inhumane because we don't have enough equipment to work.
Para protegernos de las sustancias tóxicas.
We don't have protective equipment to protect ourselves from toxic substances.
Y el espacio en que trabajamos es muy reducido.
And it's a very tight space where we're working.
You work on the U.S.-Mexico border for a U.S.-based company. How has free trade specifically affected you and your life? Usted trabaja ahí en la frontera por una compañía transnacional norteamericana. ¿Cómo le afecta en su vida cotidiana el libre comercio?
pues en mi día cotidiano me afecta moralmente, físicamente y socialmente, porque no me puedo relacionar con, o sea, si tener un día de descanso.
It affects me morally, physically, and socially because I can't have a day of rest.
Darles tiempo a mis hijos para platicar.
I can't have time to talk with my children.
Sobre sus problemas que ellos tienen, no sobre los problemas que yo tengo.
About the problems that they have or the problems that I have.
Es muy difícil para mí porque yo quisiera que el gobierno entendiera que también nosotros los pobres tenemos derecho a vivir.
It's very difficult for me because I'd like the government to know that poor people, we also have a right to live.
Y que tal vez él nunca ha llegado a su casa y no tenga que comer.
Maybe they've never arrived to their house and discovered that they have nothing to eat.
Yo quiero que mis hijos sigan estudiando.
I want my children to be able to continue studying.
Y les sirva a la sociedad.
And to be useful to society.
Desafortunadamente ya nos acabó el tiempo, pero muchísimas gracias por estar aquí. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Amparo Reyes works for the Ford Maquiladora in northern Mexico. We thank you so much for joining us. Glenn Mpufane is with Salnet in South Africa. We thank you both so much for joining us.
What happens to workers, families, and entire communities when jobs go overseas? Our next two guests have a lot to say about those kind of questions. Jeff Crosby is the president of a union local that represents General Electric employees. Thanks for joining us here.
Thanks for having us.
And Mary Fleur worked in a rubber glove factory in Ohio, as I understand it, for 16 years until the factory moved to Mexico. Welcome to World Trade Watch.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Mary Fleur, let's start with you. You worked in a small town in Ohio, and I wanted to ask what that experience was like and then what occurred when the plant disappeared.
Small town, Ohio. The people there are community people. They work together to develop the community to what it is. And I apologize for my voice because I did so much demonstrating yesterday. I'm about to lose it, but what I want to tell the people that when the factories are there, this was a hard-working people that worked in these factories. They started there at a generation when you had to go to work to make a living. A lot of them started there when they were 18 years of age. And when the factory announced they were going to close, a lot of my workers were 55, 58 years of age. And they just devastated their whole lives when the factory closed. But not only was it an impact on the workers, it was the tax dollars generated by the factory for the community. It was the volunteer that these workers did for the community. It was the dollars they generated into the small businesses. When the factory closed and went to Mexico, it devastated the whole community.
And what's happened since then? Can you give us a kind of a bird's eye view of your own experience in the last couple of years?
As the factory was closing and phasing out, some of the workers felt like there was hopelessness. My workers had attempts of suicide. Some of them had heart attacks. We buried a couple of our fellow workers because they just got so upset over the whole situation that it forced a heart attack on them. About 10 to 15 of my workers are all on medications. They're developing stress-related illnesses that they never had. But you have to keep in mind that these workers are long-generated workers of the factory, and they're odor, and it's like taking them out instead of the company rewarding them with a retirement check for their services and dedication. They got rewarded with an unemployment check and out the door. And the company and the management didn't care.
Jeff Crosby, you are with IUE and worked at the GE plant. GE has been moving a lot of its plants over the border to Mexico, and IUE has been doing cross-border organizing electronics workers like Amparo, who was here, and workers in this country. Can you talk a little bit about the day-to-day impacts when a company picks up and moves on workers on both sides of the border?
Yeah, General Electric is in an all-out effort right now, particularly to move its aircraft engine work overseas. That's what we make in Lynn, Massachusetts. In addition, it's called a meeting in Monterey of its aircraft engine suppliers, Monterey, Mexico, and instructed them that they will also move to Mexico, and if they don't, they will do no more business with General Electric. That affects other members of my local union who work at Amatec Aerospace in Wilmington, Massachusetts. That's a plant which receives quality awards, actually Supplier of the Year awards from General Electric. It's profitable. It's a good workforce. It's a good place to work. And they're now under a death threat from General Electric. So what we're doing is trying to ask a simple question. If GE made $10 billion last year, how much is enough? And we've gone several times, met with Mexican workers from the Maquiladoras in the Juarez area, General Electric workers also from Brazil, Malaysia, and a number of other countries. I think one of the things you saw today, besides the integration or at least coordination of the environmental movement and labor movement here in Seattle, is you saw a lot more of an international cast to the labor movement, and I think that's going to be happening more and more.
Mary, your plant also picked up and went to Monterrey, Mexico. When you hear someone like Amparo Reyes break down in tears because she works a 70-hour week and she can't put food on the table for her two kids as a single mother, you know what has happened to your life personally. How does that make you feel?
It brings tears to my eyes because my father came out of a generation during the Depression. It'd be a year ago tomorrow, he died. One of the last things he told me before he died, this world was bad when I came into it, but I made it better for you. And it's your responsibility to make it better for your children. And why I'm here for the WTO is I am going to try to make it better for my children. Because what's happening is our corporate managers, like in Monterrey, Mexico, not only are they devastating the workers of America, they're devastating the workers of the global environment. Everybody here suffers. And so it saddens me. I have tears for her, too, and all the workers that are being exploited through the world.
You know, I wanted to ask both of you what the context is of these protests this week in Seattle for you back in your own communities. What will it mean, do you think, in the months and years ahead?
I think be about 200 million people in the United States this morning are going to pick up their newspaper and say, what exactly is this WTO that everybody's so pissed off about? And I know in my town, we helped get rid of a congressman who voted for NAFTA. I think public opinion is very strong on our side, and I think we're winning. You know, now we have to move from, better organization, we've got to move from just that potential to actually implementing some changes in things like the World Trade Organization. But our town understands that they live, the wages that General Electric workers make has an awful lot to do with the quality of life in Lynn, Massachusetts, in the North Shore area. And we're working over several years now with a number of faith-based organizations, churches, and temples to try to help with economic development in the town. So I think our community is very strongly behind the union workers and the non-union workers, for that matter, and even managers who don't have a voice and can't speak out about what's going on. And so that gives me a lot of hope.
Mary Fleur, what about it's Attica, Ohio, right?
Right. I believe that why I'm here and what's happening and what I see I went back to college because of being a dislocated worker, but my purpose in bringing my story here to Seattle and what I hope to achieve by this is bring public awareness out. I am totally amazed how many people really don't know the issues. So I am hoping that the issues will be brought out into the community so people understand both sides and can debate them what is the right thing to do.
Well, tell us a little bit about Attica, Ohio. What happened when that plant picked up and left? How many families were left without work?
Before Willard, Ohio used to be the biggest employer of the community was Pioneer. It employed about 1,000 people. But since its free trade agreement, it's been a NAFTA disease. It just eats at you until it finally devastates you, eats you up, destroys you, and kills you. But what happens is these are older workers. The workers that worked there for 25 to 30 years. They have perfect attendance. They worked the overtime. They were dedicated workers.
Well, thanks to you and also to Jeff Crosby for being here today. We really appreciate you joining us on World Trade Watch.
It was our pleasure.
Thank you.
That wraps it up for this edition of World Trade Watch. Special thanks to KUOW and our engineer, Doug Patterson. Our producer is Philip Babich. Executive producers, Peggy Law and Josh Carliner. Associate producer, Stephanie Welch. World Trade Watch is a co-production of the National Radio Project, Corporate Watch, and the Institute for Public Accuracy. For more information on this series or a tape or transcript, call 1-800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for a free information packet. That's 800-529-5736. You can also find us on the web at www.corpwatch.org. That's corpwatch.org. Thanks for joining us. With Julie Light, I'm Norman Solomon. Thanks for listening.